It's showtime.
Bob Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy. And here we go. We are off and running with a brand new broadcast week at the Horn. HeadOn.live is where we live. That's where you go if you'd like to pick yourself out a screen name and a password. Jump right into the chat room, the Barry Madcap Zany Wacky real-time multimedia extravaganza that takes place during the 3 hours in which this program is live. Yes, if you do that, you will be immediately greeted, and they will. They're really good at greeting people. You'll be greeted by the likes of Anatole and Little Thunder and Rally and Squeaky, and moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a spacing guild master, has in fact folded space to become Man Cave. Yes. It's about 2 minutes past the hour, and we begin every program here at the Horn with thanks, because it is a community, not a commercial enterprise. It's a community of like-minded individuals of good faith, and those like-minded individuals of good faith keep this on the air. We don't have any George Soros money checks rolling in, or George Clooney money checks rolling in, or, well, any celebrity liberal money checks rolling in. I wish we did. And not even for the Gulf Stream 5. Just to help keep things, well, a little closer, a little further. Yeah, to keep the lupine pest a little further away from the porch, let's put it that way. But we do have subscribers, and we thank those subscribers on at the beginning of every program. So thanks go out this evening to Nancy in Virginia. Thank you very kindly, Nancy. Thank you very kindly to Dwayne in PA. Thanks ever so much to Marcia in Oregon. Thank you very kindly to Tom in PA. Thanks as well go out to our old buddy Ron in the not quite yet but will be soon frozen north, who made good on a bet. We wagered, and just a friendly wager, mind you. Ron felt confident enough to say that he felt sure that Joe Manchin would do the right thing and vote against Brett Kavanaugh. Well, I hate to take people's money that way, but that was a bet I couldn't resist because I knew it was safe and I'd never have to pay up. So thanks very kindly to Ron in the far frozen north. Thank you as well to Catherine in Ohio. Thank you, Catherine. So thank you so very much. And of course, we had more subscribers over the weekend. For instance, thanks go out to our buddy Dr. Allen in Texas. Thank you, Dr. Allen. And they go out to Reed in California. Thank you, Reed. Thanks also go to Susan in Massachusetts. Thank you very, very kindly, Susan. And then going back to Saturday, thanks to Laurel, and thanks very kindly to Chris in Germany. Thanks ever so much to Don in West Tennistan. Thanks as well to Kim and Malin in New Jersey. Our gratitude is extended also to our old buddy Sal. Thank you, Sal. Thank you very kindly. Thanks as well to Kitty in Boston. Thanks to Bob in North Carolina. Thanks to Brock in PA. And thanks to Alex in New York. So that's the those are the subscribers for Saturday, Sunday, and this morning. If you'd like to be a subscriber, well, the way you do that is you go to headon.live, you click on PayPal, and there's a little box there that says make this happen every month at the same time. And you click that, and assuming you put down like 10 bucks, well, you will be giving away about somewhere between a quarter and an eighth of the cost of a cup of coffee, whether it be McDonald's or Starbucks or whomever, just to keep liberal, independent, progressive media on the air that broadcasts without fear or favor and owes no allegiance to any corporation or any organization. Okay. So that's how that works. Of course, there's always Patreon as well. The Patreon link is also at headon.live. And those contributions come out on the first of every month. Same. And it would be wonderful if we could, one way or the other, you know, the goal is always $410 a month subscribers. And we're not at 100. But, you know, we do manage to, because some subscribe for a little more and some subscribe for a little less. But thank you to our subscribers who go to whose efforts go to knocking out about a quarter of our fundraising goal every month. Now, taking into account the kindnesses of the past weekend, I can tell you that we have $375 to raise this evening. We finished off the week down $250, but we got some a little bit of help along the way, and thank you very kindly to those I previously mentioned. So we need to raise $375 this evening. And because this operation always runs on the last frayed thread of a dry-rotted tennis shoe lace, it's very real when I say that raising that $375 makes sure that there's, you know, still a program on the air, say, by the end of this week. So, you know, let's say that's 10 folks at $36. Or 36 people at $10. Lord knows the people who contribute to the program are far outnumbered by the people who listen to the program. And, you know, more participation would be magnificent, to say the very least. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. I don't think I did that part. So here we are at 9 minutes past the hour, and it is, of course, it's the beginning of the week. And, of course, the beginning of the week means that we have had a veritable wealth of, well, you know.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up. You will not believe your ears. It's Moran Monday on the Horn. Yes, yes, here, a few tiny little steps, baby steps even, away from the main lane of the Carnival Midway, you'll find the thin cybernetic veil of the Morin Monday tent here at the Horn. Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. You can't tell the Morans without a program, and this is the program that tells the Morans you just can't tell them much. For veritable pennies, you too can pass behind the thin cybernetic veil to witness Morans of all scope, all shapes, all sizes, and all manner. That's right, we've got them all. Birchers, Deathers, Ninthers, Deathers, Booger Eaters, Maggots, Libertarians, Trumpansies, Republicans, all, and occasionally someone who isn't a member of the White Wing, but they all fall under the broad general heading of Morans. And they're right here for you. That's right, instead of throwing your money away, throwing ping pong balls at little goldfish bowls in the vain attempt of, or the vain hope of somehow or another managing to win a baby iguana, you, can instead come inside the thin cybernetic veil of canvas that is the Moran Monday tent, and we will advise you, on the front end, to be mindful and keep a hand on purses, wallets, jewelry, children, beloved animal pets. Yes, even that little baby iguana that you won throwing ping pong balls at goldfish bowls. Keep an eye on it, and especially European-style messenger bags, because the Morans can get grabby. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans. And you will. You really, really will. Look, we all know what happened over the weekend. We've got a new sociopath justice on the Supreme Court of the United States. I have rather strong feelings about it. As do you. But I confess that I'm a little bit, burned out, shall we say. That is not to say disinterested, but burned out on the sorry saga of Brett Kavanaugh. Yeah, I am. And so there was another thing that happened over the weekend that I think probably deserves our attention, rather a lot of it, our attention. But it comes with a Moran nomination, too. This nomination goes out to the copy editor at the Washington Post, who wrote the following headline. The planet is on a fast path to destruction. The media must cover this like it's the only story that matters. I agree in almost 100%. With the substance of the column written by Margaret Sullivan over at the Washington Post. But I'm also a practitioner of the art of word knowing, and a longtime fan thereof. And if you read that headline, and again it says, the planet is on a fast path to destruction. The planet is on a fast path to destruction. You know, between the is it between the Earth and Mars, or I'm forgetting my local astronomy, or is it between Mars and Jupiter? There's this thing called the asteroid belt, and for instance, those of you who enjoyed, as did I. The sci-fi series, which has been transferred over to someone else now, and will enjoy another season called The Expanse, you'll recall that some of the characters are referred to as belters because they live on the larger asteroids within the asteroid belt. Now, no one really knows for sure where the asteroid belt came from or how it came into being. But there are those who have wondered if perhaps it might be the remains of a planet that got broken all to pieces during the formation of our solar system. Just didn't quite have the right stuff to hang together and join the club that's comprised of orbiting celestial bodies like Mercury, Venus, us, Mars, Saturn, Jupiter, Neptune, Uranus, and depending on the nature of the depending on who's talking about it, Pluto, and then there's something out beyond Pluto that we're not real sure about, and for all we know, might actually be either some wayward Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses. But there's that asteroid belt. And if you read the headline from the Washington Post, you can be forgiven if you think that the Washington Post is of the opinion that there's about to be a brand new asteroid belt, say, between Venus and Mars. That would be us. The planet is on a fast path to destruction. The planet, the whole planet, just going to crumble into a billion tiny pieces of space junk. Right? Yeah. That's what it says. The planet is on a fast path to destruction. The media must cover this like it's the only story that matters. Well, you know what? If the planet was on a fast path to turning into a great big elliptically orbiting gravel road, I'd agree. I mean, that's some grim shit. That's some cancel Christmas stuff. The planet, the whole planet, is on a fast path to destruction? Boy, that's not, of course, what it's about. Okay, thanks. Thank you to Lee in New York. The asteroid belt is between Mars and Jupiter. The asteroid belt may be a potential planet that did not form, like Saturn's rings, did not become a moon. See, that's what the ad hoc Horn Research Department is for. Thank you very kindly, Lee. I knew it was something like that. Well, our planet did form, and the copy editor who writes headlines at the Washington Post just told us that it's about to sort of discorporate. And then just a whole bunch of dirt and rocks. That's pretty damn dramatic. Sad, too, because I'd kind of counted, I won't be here, you won't be here, none of us will be. Maybe the sentient race of 6-foot-tall cockroaches that worship us as gods will be. We won't. But I was kind of counting on the planet to be here when the sun goes nova and fries our little blue-green time machine hurtling in its helical way through the universe to a crisp. At least then there might be something here worth examining for, say, the multi-limbed amorphous aliens from Norblap 9 when they get here to see what used to be here. But alas, according to the Washington Post's headline writer, the planet is on a fast path to destruction. Pah, it is not. What is on a fast path to destruction is this planet's ability to support human life. And that is a far cry from the planet. It is the nature of the planet. Kind of like maybe if the multi-limbed amorphous aliens from Norblap 9 had been watching eons ago when there was water on the surface of Mars and it all began boiling away. I bet the multi-limbed amorphous aliens from Norblap 9 didn't have copy editors who wrote Mars is about is on a fast path to destruction. No, they would have looked at it and said, "Man, Mars doesn't have a magnetic core, so it looks like it's probably not going to be able to keep that water on its surface, and it's just going to boil away and become a barren and dry and rocky place." You see the distinction? And the reason I'm making is the reason I'm making this distinction, as Marty points out, fine, the planet will be fine. We all know this, the biosphere and its ability to support the human race. By the way, it's been speculated that Jupiter was going to be a star sun and just didn't quite make it. The biosphere, it's not in such good shape. Yeah, see, Asa and I, Brother Deacon Asa and I have been going back and forth about this. Asa says, I think we're splitting hairs as to what the word planet means in this context. Unless one is a member of the Toenail Toothpick Maggot Society, most folks know the word planet to mean those beings that exist on the planet in this context. I'm not prepared to concede that. Words, as the Republicans once used to love so much to remind us back during the great Cleanus hunt, words mean things. Perhaps this partakes a little bit of the philosophical argument about whether a tree falling in the forest with no one to observe it makes a sound. Insofar as sound is something that we perceive through the analog system of, and other living creatures perceive through some analog system of perception, like hearing. But I perceive, see what I did there? I perceive climate change to be of such gravity, and in fact, of such an existential nature, that I think we owe a duty to try to speak of it as accurately as we possibly may. Oh, okay, thanks, Ron and Raleigh. The expanse will be as... the expanse will be on Amazon. All I can say is better Lodi. Lodi. Belter Lodi. I guess it's time to change the glasses prescription. Belter Lodi. Have you been following the saga of the dwarf planet Goblin orbiting outside of Pluto with a solar orbit of 40,000 years? Waiting for a birthday is a bummer. Those sentient cockroaches are Republicans because you can't kill their filthy asses. Oh, they'll probably... Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'm sure they'll be just as conservative as they can be. And they will worship us as gods. Mm-hmm. But the whole point of this exercise is to note that climate change is deadly real. And there's a brand new report out. And it's frightening. It is out from the United Nations, which, of course, Republicans don't like. In a story at the Washington Post by Chris Mooney and Brady Dennis, the headline writer did a significantly better job. The world has just over a decade to get climate change under control, UN scientists say. Did you hear that? Just over a decade. That's 2028, 2030? Hell. That ain't long at all. This is a report by the single best group studying climate change that exists on the planet. Which means this planet, which means Earth, terra firma. The report says that we require a rapid and far-reaching transformation of human civilization at a magnitude that has never happened before. In the report, they state there is no documented historic precedent for the massive degree of change that has to take place in order to keep the planet to go past the 1.5 degrees Celsius, 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, warming threshold, because that threshold changes everything. It changes this planet from being a hospitable biosphere to many forms of life to being a biosphere increasingly less hospitable to us hairless primates, or, well, neotenous primates, as we wander around on the, you know, on the globe, because today is allegedly is what we shamefully refer to as Columbus Day. I will not wish you a happy Columbus Day, because there's nothing happy about Columbus Day. I don't care how many Italian-American societies march up and down the street with brass bands playing and cotton candy, and I don't care. There is nothing remotely respectable about Christopher Columbus. He was so vicious, you must understand, that among other things, by his own admission, he sold 9-year-old indigenous girls into prostitution and felt pretty good about it. Noted that they didn't have any weapons and didn't have any serious weapons and didn't have any real desire to use them on the diseased colonial white invaders. And so he took them hostage and allowed the women to be raped. Rape culture goes way back here in the Western Hemisphere. It goes back to 1492 when you're talking about the European or Eastern Hemisphere concepts of rape and sexual assault, such as you can read about in the Bible and etc. Christopher Columbus was a religious maniac, and he and his band of miscreant shipmates were lousy with disease. And so this day is more like a patient zero kind of commemoration. This was the day that spelled the beginning of the end for millions upon millions of human beings who were at that point in time successfully living in the most populous portion of the planet. More people were living in North and South America and doing so successfully and reasonably well than anywhere else on this globe, planet. But armed with his flag, the colors of blood and gold, Columbus arrived here, and even people who never even heard his name would come to rue it and curse it as they died of things that they had never seen or heard of before. And that's the ones who weren't outright raped and murdered by the white colonialists, which were not limited to the Spanish or the Portuguese, but included the French, the English, and the Dutch. and even at one point, no kidding, the Swedes. I'm not talking about the Vikings, I'm talking about Sweden. No, really, not going to go into that. But this report from the United Nations panel came as a result of a mandate from the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. And it's scary. And I'll say this because, you know, once again, if you're a member of this community, and if you're listening to this program, you are. There are no fees here. Everything is free. Everything that keeps the program on the air is voluntary. But if you've been listening to this program for a while, you know that we tend to talk about things and get things right a long, long time before the for-profit media do. And this is another one of those cases. I have made the argument for years that we, especially in the United States, but it's certainly also true of the over-industrialized so-called West, have no real conception of what it means to say that we need to reduce, reuse, recycle, and fundamentally change the way we live on this planet. Well, this report confirms what I was talking about. Again, there is no documented historic precedent, the UN panel writes, for what has to be done to stop the temperature rise that may well eliminate humanity as a species. Jim Skea, who is co-chair of the IPCC panel, and he's a professor at Imperial College London. When the document was released, he said, "Frankly, we've delivered a message to the governments. It's now their responsibility to decide whether they can act on it. What we've done is said what the world needs to do." Well, what is that? For starters, just to provide a benchmark, the report notes that we have to start down a path of reduced carbon dioxide emissions by 2030. It's difficult to even comprehend. Right now, our carbon emissions are something on the order of 40 billion tons per year. Well, in the next decade, that needs to be cut by 39 billion tons. Can't really go over a billion tons of carbon dioxide emissions per year and expect not to go over that 1.5 degrees Celsius mark. Now, you can either look at it as, well, we're fucked. Or we can at least inquire as to what would need to be done in order to reach that. Considering the amount of meat-based food porn we talk about here on this program, among other things, pretty much need to become a vegetarian planet. Stop raising animals for food. That's a big one. In urban areas, public transportation, preferably powered by renewable electrical resources, whether it be wind or solar or geothermal, would have to become the dominant mode of transportation. And the same goes for long-distance transportation, and it almost puts the idea of air travel out of existence. How about that? It's Columbus Day, and what we're talking about in terms of getting around the planet may actually mean going back to seagoing vessels that are powered by the wind and the sun. Now remember, this is something that the entire planet is going to have to agree on. In the report, it also notes that by 2050, we have to be at a place where we no longer burn any coal at all. This is going to be a problem. And not even so much from an energy standpoint. It doesn't say phase out the burning of coal for energy. It says phase out the burning of coal. This is going to be a real pain in the ass for the steel industry, which means we're going to have technological innovations that make steel unnecessary. Think about that for a little bit. Now, where the burning of coal is concerned, there is also the this reinvigorates the notion of, well, we've got to figure out some way to carbon capture and store the carbon that comes off the burning of coal. I think we've explored that to its logical conclusion, and its logical conclusion is you can't do it. You have to put more energy into capturing the carbon than you get out of combusting the carbon. So that's going to be a non-starter. And maybe you could capture the carbon emissions off of steel making, but nothing else. But it requires an imagination of what human occupation of the human occupational patterns and settlement patterns look like. More people, and it's kind of a first time in history sort of thing, more people on this planet live in coastal areas and in cities generally than at any other time in human history. And that means that for people who are in concentrated areas, transportation issues will not be as difficult. It'll be a difficult hurdle, but it will not be as difficult a hurdle as it is for people like, well, say, me, who live out here in the hinterlands and have to drive, say, a 15-mile round trip to go to the grocery store. Now, in that instance, we're talking about transportation systems that become utterly non-reliant on fossil fuels. Not gasoline, not petrochemicals, not natural gas, not coal. So we're probably talking about electric cars. Okay, cool. I love electric cars. How are you going to charge them? Well, solar. Groovy. How are we going to afford the solar? Well, people will buy solar panels. How are they going to do that when they can't even afford the electric car? Do you see what I'm getting at? Every problem, it's like one of those Russian nesting dolls where every time you open up one, there's another one inside it. Note coming in from Matt in San Francisco. Oh, Bob, remember the solar panels on the roof of the White House? Thank goodness Ronnie Reagan came along and made sure to push the train back on the wrong track. I'm firmly in the camp of the we're screwed, which in some ways is liberating, thinking of all this, mortgages that will go unpaid. On the other hand, everyone being dead and or suffering through the might of Mother Nature is a definite bummer. I'm not looking forward to boating down Market Street. Ah, but who cares? 45 should have us blown up by then. And it's hard to argue with any of that, Matt. But, for instance, all of those concentrated populations in coastal areas are probably going to have to figure out a way to migrate inland. Because the sea level rise that's on the way as a result of what we've already done is likely to inundate coastal areas that aren't, you know, really, really high up above the water. So we're talking about San Diego, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Portland, Seattle, Vancouver. That's just the west coast of the United States. Then there's Houston, New Orleans, Mobile, Pensacola, the entire west coast of Florida and the northern northern Gulf part of it, which has a hurricane, a Category 3 hurricane bearing down on it, by the way. The Keys are gone. Most of Miami is too. Say goodbye to Daytona and Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, Wilmington, Savannah, Charleston. Outer Banks, underwater. And you know what? You'll probably be able to fish off of one of the porticos of the United States Capitol in a couple of hundred years. We haven't even gotten to Philly, New York, and Boston yet. And that's just the Western Hemisphere because it's Columbus Day. Ron in Raleigh says, I keep asking the question, if we all become vegans, what the hell do we do with the billions of food animals in existence? I can't see a viable solution to this problem alone. Algae is being used as a fuel alternative. No, obviously you don't turn the CAFOs out to just happily wander the land. That's no solution. At some point, you just have to stop. You know, all stop. Soylent Green. I don't like the things I'm talking about. But then again, I don't like what we did that made us have to talk about it. We're talking about the problem itself is born out of scientific ignorance. You can study, for instance, the history of coal back to a time when it was referred to as jet and then referred to as sea coal, S-E-A-C-O-A-L. And you will find, for instance, in the earliest days of coal's combustion in England, that at one point in time, the king banned the burning of it because it was so toxic and so noxious. But that didn't last. But even though it was filthy, humanity has this habit of taking the path of least resistance. And lest I be accused of letting anyone off the hook, there's an interesting comparison that in point of fact, the island of Great Britain and the Mayan cultures had deforested their lands to an almost a state of near totality at roughly the same period in history. I believe it's Jared Diamond who makes this argument. And he points out that the reason that England proceeds onward, whereas Mayan culture collapses, is that about that time the English discovered coal. And so that gave them a chance to a certain extent, reforest their island and burn the aforementioned noxious, toxic mineral. I guess we can call it a mineral. It's carbon. And from that day forward, it becomes humanity becomes a study in attempts to find things that are combustible. Until by 1972, when he's writing in, I think, Breakfast of Champions, and driving through the state of West Virginia, Kilgore Trout notices, in the words of Kurt Vonnegut, that in less than 100 years, the people of West Virginia had destroyed their entire state for heat. But I reiterate what I have previously said. No one really has a handle on what's going to be necessary to make humanity remain viable as a species on a warming planet. In there are aspects of it that are so awful that we can barely even talk about them. It is almost inconceivable that these sort of changes could be brought about without massive loss of human life. And, of course, when we talk about massive loss of human life, we've been putting up with it to one degree or another for a very long time. Stalin's 15 million, Hitler's 10, the Armenian genocide perpetrated by the Turks, Rwanda, and of course, this being Columbus Day, the tens of millions of human beings who were rubbed out as a result of the colonization of this hemisphere. We really can't even get a handle on the numbers. We only know that it was tens upon tens upon tens of millions. And, of course, famine and death are parts of various and sundry myths, legends, and early proto-histories of human societies. Yeah, Randy in PA points out 56 million out of World War II in total. Or, you know, the modern famines in places like Ethiopia and South Sudan. We have a hard time talking about this. John says, subject line, doom. Unless we move to a resource-based economy, we're truly hosed. The problem is not the tech, it's the money. And I will add, if the problem is the money, then the problem is capitalism. Capitalism got us here, okay? Let's at least be honest enough with ourselves to take note of that. Capitalism as an economic system assumed that all resources are exploitable for purposes of profit, and that all resources are infinite. Premise one is subject to argument. Premise two is just plain wrong. But because it was exploited as though it were infinite, well, here we are. Ron and Raleigh with a note. Remember, the Netherlands have been below sea level for quite a long time. Venice is a city of canals. We can deal with ocean rise if we will admit that it's happening. However, the temperature rise is what's going to get us. Well, Venice continues to sink, and the Netherlands, the polders of the Netherlands, have to be constantly maintained. And the question is whether we could get... And that's maintained at the status they were presently, they were then in their present time. The kind of sea level rise that we're looking at coming on now may be a different animal altogether. Lee in New York says, solutions that have a next problem. I have a, there's a hole in the bucket, dear Liza, in my head. Matt in San Francisco says, name change, the horn equals ray of fucking sunshine. Maybe we should have sunshine day for fuckers. We'll take that under advisement, Matt. You can go and read the report. I suggest having something strong nearby, because you're going to need it. By 2050, there will be 2 billion more human beings on this planet. Among other things, they discuss in the report taking vast swaths of land that are currently used for growing crops and using them for growing trees to capture carbon. Then the plants and the trees would be used as part of what is described as a currently non-existent program to get power from trees or plants and then bury the resulting carbon dioxide emissions in the ground. It's called bioenergy with carbon capture and storage. And again, you can put the carbon in the ground, probably as a in CO2 form, but then you have to figure out a way to keep it there. Because if it gets loose, anybody near it dies. Because contrary to Republican opinion, you cannot breathe carbon dioxide and survive. The folks writing the report were pretty sober sides, and so there's no screaming or carrying on in it. They simply say, such large transactions pose profound challenges for sustainable management of the various demands on land for human settlements, food, livestock feed, fiber, bioenergy, carbon storage, biodiversity, and other ecosystem services. It has about a 34-page, the report does, about a 34-page executive summary. I do recommend getting your hands on it. And then reading it and trying to imagine where you fit into the process. Or more frighteningly, if we fit into the process. The business about coal is what grabs me because, of course, I live in a place where coal is revered is treated with a reverence that is most often reserved for gods. Here in Central Appalachia, we should probably carve all of our Virgin Marys and all of our crescent and stars and all of our stars of David and all of our crosses out of coal, because coal is what is worshipped here. But this report, among other things, taken in the context of Central Appalachia, also provides a stark reminder of just how suicidally, ignorant Donald Trump is, as well as the people who helped to put him into office. Donald Trump and the Republicans' approach to coal, and some Democrats. Hi, Joe. Well, it's the functional equivalent of the alcoholic who has been told, "One more drink, and you die." And having someone walk up to that person and hand them, you know, a fifth of bourbon and a straw and say, drink up, buddy. This report grabbed me and pretty much threw me around the room. I mean, I don't like being a glass half empty guy, but it's the politics and the economics that are going to kill us. We have a political system in this country that is woefully unsuited to dealing with this problem, and then we as a culture and a nation are one of the biggest parts of that problem. But saying that is not the same as having an idea on how to go forward. For instance, Elbert in Rhode Island points out, during the Old West, people used horses and oxen to pull their wagons. That they did. And most people at that point in time never went more than 10 or 15 miles from the place they were born. we don't have that kind of an economy anymore. As recently as 50 years ago, just down the road from me, there was a general store, and it carried everything. It wasn't a grocery store. You went to the counter and you told them what you wanted, and they brought it to you. Oddly enough, that idea of personal shopping is making a comeback. But those things are gone. The goods that they sold were largely delivered on railroad trains, the tracks of which have been torn up and haven't run for decades, near a century. When we get into the conversation part of the program, which we more or less are, I'd be interested in hearing any ideas you might, or any visions you might have for what this future looks like. Randy in PA says, if you had an inexhaustible form of energy like fusion, you could artificially extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and, I guess, make millions of fire extinguishers out of it. Then natural heat exhalation into space would take over. Can you say 200.org? Yeah, and the problem is, well, it's like that old joke about the mechanical engineer, the civil engineer, and the economist who are stranded on a desert island. They've got canned food and no way to open it. The civil engineer builds a fire and causes the can to explode and the food blows all over the place, so that didn't work. The mechanical engineer builds a big Rube Goldberg device and swings the can into a rock and it splats and the food goes all over the place and there's nothing to eat then. And they both look to the economist and they say, well, what did you come up with? And the economist says, hypothesize a can opener. See, this has been one of the big problems with climate change going, as we pondered it, is that we think that at some point in time there's going to be some sort of a magic bullet that is going to be discovered by some enterprising scientist and save us all. That is on a par with thinking that, well, okay, we may be in bad shape, but the amorphous multi-limbed aliens from Norblap 9 will be here any minute, and they'll give us the technology that we need to make frisbees and wheat checks and draw lines on the Nazca Plains like they did before and to teach us how to make grain silo pyramids. Dangerous business, that. Magical thinking, that. We can hypothesize all sorts of stuff, but ultimately, we have to solve the problems with the tools we have at hand. Well, yeah, absolutely. Ron in Raleigh says, hey, don't forget, how about the African diaspora, the Middle Passage, and the colonial murders on the continent? It all begins on this date, 526 years ago. Scott in San Diego, rising ocean level effect, San Diego. According to a website I looked at, if the ultimate sea level rise occurs while I'm still living at my present address, I'll be at 393 feet above sea level. Good thing I'm not still at my address in Imperial Beach, where I lived from 2003 to 2008. Down there, I'd be at just 36 feet above sea level. Randy says, what do you think that Lawrence Livermore Labs works on? Right, but working on is not the same as having the technology at hand. And once you've got the technology at hand, you have to scale it up. And it also has to, remember, be carbon, either hopefully at least carbon neutral and preferably carbon negative. I thought it would be beneficial to sort of focus on this at the beginning of the program, simply as a sort of reminder that there are things more important out there than individual, and you know, than what we've been dealing with for the past 2 weeks. Now, what we've been dealing with for the past 2 weeks with a sociopath justice, Brett Kavanaugh, now on the court, well, it means that if we try to do something about climate change, really, you know, if somehow by some miracle we can wrest the Congress and the House of Representatives away from the people who were part of the death cult that is known as the Republican Party, and get rid of Donald Trump in 2020, well, Brett Kavanaugh and Ann's boy Neil and John Roberts and Alito and Slappy Coke Can, Slappy Pubes on the Coke Can Thomas, well, they're going to be sitting there just waiting. And there will be corporations with scads of money waiting to file suits to stop whatever it is we try to do to save this planet's ability to support human life. Mm-hmm. Remember, we're talking about 1.5 degrees Celsius. Well, even the Trump regime, which still, I believe, officially holds that climate change is a Chinese hoax to steal all our industry, their analysis says that we're looking at a 4 degrees Celsius temperature rise in the next 82 years if we do nothing. And that if we do nothing is a big thing, because doing nothing means everything stays the same. We make just as much stuff. We burn just as much fossil fuel. Well, that's not going to happen. The Trump regime, and generally speaking, the Republican Party, wants to burn more because they view that as wealth generation. The hollowed-out State Department is trying to put as good a spin on it as they can. A spokescreep there said, from 2005 to 2017, U.S. CO2-related emissions declined by 14%, while global energy-related CO2 emissions rose by 21% during the same time. This has been possible through the development and large-scale deployment of new, affordable, and cleaner technologies to capitalize on our energy abundance, which means we're going to keep burning coal, we're going to keep burning gas, we're going to keep boiling, we and our Canadian friends will keep boiling sludge out of the tar sands. And gather ye rosebuds while ye may, and eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow ye die, motherfucker. So, like I said, it's just something to talk about. Something deeply, existentially vital to talk about. And, you know, it, like I said, I would genuinely like to have a conversation about what the coming world looks like. Not the coming world of 2200 CE, but the coming world of 2030. Barkway in the chat room says, what possible constitutional arguments can be made to favor the destruction of the planet? That's not how it'll happen. Let's say there's a... Let's take a hypothetical and say that there's a law that says carbon-based energy must be phased out by 2030. Well, every carbon-based energy company in the country is going to sue. They're going to claim, for instance, maybe, that the law constitutes an unconstitutional taking of property without due process of law. Well, Dead-Eyed John Roberts and Sammy Bad Breath and Clarence Slappy Pubes on the Coke Can Thomas and Ann's Boy Neil and Brat will be just sitting there waiting to go, yep, unconstitutional. Burn more coal, fuckers. That's just the tip of the iceberg. But to go back now to the story with which I started the program, the one with the stupid headline, the planet is on a fast path to destruction. The media must cover this like it's the only story that matters. The writer, the author, the media columnist for the Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan, is on the right track. She says, after a week of dire news, the certainty of our ruptured nation, the likelihood of a journalist being murdered, the United Nations report on climate change was, for some people, a bridge too far. I heard something about it, a normally well-informed friend told me, but I'm on a week-long hiatus from the news. Well, good for you, sunshine. For those who are still able to take it in, the report could hardly have been more frightening. By 2040, only 22 years from now, the world will be in deep trouble, according to the unassailable expertise of the UN's experts. Food shortages, wildfires, and the mass death of coral reefs are just some of the dangers. She goes on to note, that story on the report was the most prominent one on the Post's homepage on Monday morning, and in almost as prominent a place in the New York Times, as well as both papers' print front pages. It got prominent attention on TV, too. But it will need sustained emphasis by the media and the public all over the world if we stand a chance of maintaining a livable planet. See, she knows. This is something worth pointing out. Reporters and authors don't write their own headlines. If we are to stand a chance of maintaining a livable planet. Not if the planet is to be prevented from breaking into a bajillion tiny pieces and turning into a new asteroid belt. She cites Philip Gurevich, an author and New Yorker staff writer, who took to Twitter and said, a bracing reminder that every issue we devote attention to other than climate change is really a secondary issue. And that's a viable position to take. However, there is not going to be a non-governmental solution to temperature rise and carbon emissions on this planet. Not as long as this planet is running on some version of capitalism 2.0. Which, by the way, in many instances, is worse than capitalism 1.0. Because capitalism 2.0, at least as practiced in the United States, is capitalism merged with the anarchist strain of I've got mine, fuck you, that comes from the fetishization of the horrible science fiction works of one Ayn Rand. You know, if you want a libertarian science fiction writer, I still say Robert Heinlein did it a lot better. If you want some idea of a utopian libertarian society, go read The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. Interestingly, in there is also a discussion about the ability of technological innovation to save a doomed society. It's not a bad book. And there's a bunch of bullshit libertarian political philosophy in it and theory. But some of the stuff that he talks about, because Heinlein did have at least an engineering/science background, is quite fascinating to ponder. Margaret Sullivan tries to sound a little bit of an alarm. She says, "Recall that in the three presidential debates, not a single question was asked about climate change, nor was it raised in the vice presidential debates. Since his election, President Trump has turned his back on national and global efforts to control the problem, essentially saying it's going to happen anyway, so why bother to try to stop it?" And then she points out the various and sundry distractions available to make it possible not to think about what it is we've been talking about for the last hour and 16 minutes or so of the program. Let's call it hour. And so that's another one of those questions that we've identified. How do you go about conducting that debate? Take a moment, because this is just a real blast. Imagine trying to talk about climate change with the maggots. You say, listen, we've got to get down to zero carbon emissions by 2050. And the maggot, especially a maggot around here, looks at you and goes, "Coke keeps it light, son. Big, gerbil black maggot." At which point you go home and start digging your cellar and I don't know. Brother Deacon Asa points out, "I've done the math, Bob. If y'all weren't spending $750 billion, y'all being the United States, on killing infrastructure every year, you could electrify the entire United States with renewables in less than 20 years. But that would mean not blowing brown countries to kingdom come for 20 years. Well, can't have that. I mean, are there non-governmental solutions to climate change? Here's a hypothetical. What if the entire world, including the developing world that now wants to live as well as, say, this country and the developed world has lived for 100 years or so, what if the developing world stops and says, okay, everybody's not going to have a car. And what if the entire world except the United States gets together and says, we're going to save humanity, or we're going to save humanity's ability to live on this planet, and we're going to do everything necessary to do it? What happens when dealing with us becomes the greatest hurdle to saving humanity's ability to live on the planet? What's that look like, Sunshine? And what happens? So, because in the present configuration, the answer is Donald Trump decides to nuke the entire world, the rest of the world nukes us, and then the planet is no longer fit for human life anyway, and we don't have to worry about climate change.
Because there'll already be climate change, just of a different kind. Libby, with a note, the vision, climate chaos, the vision I have had for a long time, especially since going deep into gloomy doomer, 6 billion die, if not more. Those left, if lucky, will have horses and buggies, gardens, etc. The next best scenario is the proverbial back to the cave. That's the most plausible, if nuclear Armageddon does not wipe everything out to a Mars-Venus planet. But then again, maybe we can do it and still have a grid, computers to stay connected. Yours truly. Libby of the People Anonymous. P.S. Just bought all three of the Silo trilogy by Hugh Howey, a superb sci-fi masterpiece. Highly recommended. I may need to check that out. And here I sit in one of the most water-rich regions of the planet. Guess what? We've poisoned it. So some guy 100 years ago could squirrel his money away so some rotten little kid could start their freshman year at Harvard or Yale or whatever this year. Beautiful, isn't it? Lee in New York, subject line climate change. Maggot answers to climate change. Ain't you never seed a rainbow? God promised not to destroy the world again. MAGA. End times are coming. It don't matter. Jesus gonna be here any minute. Meanwhile, Barclay in the chat room says, Bob. Barclay, that's gimmick infringement. Ron's gonna be upset. The elites driving Armageddon for ever-increasing profits don't have to be concerned with Armageddon because they've all invested in luxury doomsday bunkers. You know, I do. I confess, I often wonder what's going on down on all that land that the Bush family bought on the, what is it, the Paraguay-Bolivia border frontier area? Yeah. So, that's a starting place for the conversation this evening. But it does dovetail and overlap with our politics. It does, as I think I have demonstrated, have something to do with what we spent the last couple of weeks involved in. I was sitting outside in the early October, 80 degree sunshine here, and I watched the final vote on the confirmation of a sociopath justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh, and I heard the impassioned pleas of people in the gallery, and of course Vice President Mike Pencilneck Geek was playing president of the Senate in case he had to break a tie. And every now and then when some woman would scream in her agony and rage, Mike Pencilneck Geek would say, "We remind our guests in the gallery to remain quiet during the vote." In other words, shut up, little ladies. We know what's good for you. But because I actually believe in representative democracy, and I actually took to heart the idea that we, the people, are the ones who are in charge. Every time he said our guests in the gallery, it pissed me off. And somewhere along the way, I think I remarked on social media somewhere, hey, dumbass, those aren't your guests. Those are your bosses. Those are your employers. Because it's true. And because real democracy, not the stuff we do and call democracy, real democracy is rowdy. It sometimes involves people shouting. But that's okay. They got the vote their way. And then they went out, the Republicans did, and celebrated with a hashtag called Beers for Brett. Among other things, John Cornholio of Texas,
well, he's not a beer guy. He's a champagne guy.
That's right. The Republicans in the Senate brought out the champagne to celebrate the fact that they had just gotten a guy onto the Supreme Court with fewer votes than any other member of the Supreme Court has ever had in ascending to that tawdry institution. Because, well, Brett Kavanaugh could never have been an sociopath justice of the Supreme Court under the rules that were in existence for every other justice except Ann's boy, Neil. How about that? Meanwhile, News Ninja Gene across the pond says, well, shit, Bob. So does this mean that in order to save humanity, you have to break up the USA and somehow manage to avoid 50 corporate states? Or is it easier to impeach the entire SCOTUS? Well, impeaching the entire Supreme Court is not easy, and it is not even possible. At least not until there are 67 senators willing to do that job. So that's... well, maybe we'll get into that later. But, by the way, I should probably mention, because I haven't said anything since the beginning of the program, we are at the halfway mark of the program this evening. And we had $375 to raise this evening, and we have $375 to raise this evening. And if we don't get back on track with fundraising, you know, we're past operating month to month. We're down to, you know, certain weeks being make or break here. This is one of those weeks. Scott in San Diego says, I saw a photo of Kavanaugh being sworn in, probably on one of Nixon's trick Bibles, with all the pages blank. As I looked at the photo, I wondered which of Kavanaugh's hands was the one he put on Dr. Ford's mouth at the party, the right one on the trick Bible or the left one that he had raised. By the way, I suggested in a little piece over the weekend that it really would be beneficial if the women on the Supreme Court would not afford Brett Kavanaugh the legitimacy of their company. Unfortunately, among other people, well, unfortunately, Ruth Bader Ginsburg showed up for Brett Kavanaugh's swearing in. Now, if you go in for flights of fancy, maybe she looked at him. Maybe you could fantasize that she looked at him and said, "Hey, bub, I believe Dr. Ford," but that would have been reported, and that didn't happen. No, they're going to maintain the fraud that there's some sort of comity on the Supreme Court when we all know that it's a tawdry political cesspool, and we know what its history is. The Adam Serwer piece that some people have referred to over at the Atlantic is highly instructive. But he's on there, and he's going to get right to work. Oh, yes, indeedy. CBS News reporting. That he will have plenty of fun stuff to play with right from jump. And, of course, they're having a swearing-in ceremony for Brett, even though he's already been sworn in. Even as we speak. And so we, you know, Susan Collins, please. And then there's Joe Manchin. Oh, let's see. My little ray of sunshine disease seems to be catching. Note coming from Alexander. Now, you and I already know we aren't going to inconvenience ourselves by doing those things necessary to combat climate change, global warming. And besides, it's not financially stable or sound. The greedy corporatists of this world, white and white supremacists of color, are willing to literally sacrifice the planet and everything and everyone on it, all in the name of the fucking dollar. Remember, Brother Kincaid, from a corporatist perspective, destroying the planet and killing off all living things, including us human beings, is simply those unavoidable costs of doing business. Shit happens, right? Yeah. But to turn it back just for a moment. Oh, and by the way, thank you very kindly. We just went down to 350 to go. I don't know if that was anonymous or not. I need to know. So let me know, and I will gladly acknowledge. Well, that's true. Jeff from Hellhole, Indiana says, even as they're swearing in Kavanaugh, I find myself doing a lot of swearing, too. I know the feeling. I know it will. But let's do engage in some conversation radio. The lines are open. 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178. Or 304-640-2829, or 844-THE-HORN, 844-843-4676. And, of course, from anywhere on the planet, Skype to Skype, Bob Kincaid, Horn. Don't just let me sit here and prattle on about what this report means. It means one thing to me. It may mean vastly different things to you. Geography alone can play a big part. Rural versus urban. And I mean urban as in city, not as in the right-wing dog whistle meaning black. Rural versus urban makes a difference because the problems and solutions are different. U.S. versus other countries makes a difference. So chime in. Wow, thank you very kindly. David, in Albuquerque. I knew I should have taken that left, Twain. David in Albuquerque says, let me be the first of 10 today to kick in $36. Keep the faith. Thank you, David. Thank you tremendously. So that takes us down to, oh dear, ciphering again. 314 to go. Thank you, David. Thank you so much. Jeff from Hellhole, Indiana. No, wait a minute. Well, that's a blank one. I don't know what that was, Jeff, but maybe resend it. Anatole says that's why we need a movement. Well, I remember several years ago being out at Netroots Nation in Las Vegas, and Majora Carter and the head of Greenpeace and the head of the Sierra Club, Big Greens, told us that the so-called environmental movement could never motivate people the way the civil rights movement did. And it was infuriating then. And unfortunately, it appears to have become a self-fulfilling prophecy now. Arnold tells me capitalism only looks at it in the lifetime of the shareholders, not the generations yet to come. And that's, but they don't even look at it in the lifetimes of the shareholders, because the corporation itself is immortal. And when you get right down to it, just from on a purely theoretical level, corporations can survive without people. Because as long as the paperwork is there, it's still a corporation, even though, you know, there's no people to run it. Maybe the paperwork will still be there when the sentient 6-foot-tall cockroaches crawl up out of the slime that we have left of our own attempt at life, and they'll say, look, hey, I'll be damned, we're Koch Industries now. Ha! Praise gods. They must have left that for us. Yeah, sorry, don't mean to be such a delightful soul. Shall we go into some other stuff on this here Morian Monday? Oh, wait. That cowbell is for Laurel. Cockroach Industries. Yeah, you definitely get a cowbell for that. That wasn't what I was thinking. That's a perfect play on. Yes, sir, that's good. Cockroach Industries, because those people millions of years ago loved us enough to make it for us. And, yeah, we now have... who knows, but we now have, especially if you go back to pre-Civil War America, who knows how many sexual assault perpetrators we had on the court back then. If you had a member of the Supreme Court who owned slaves, it was almost guaranteed that you had one then. But in terms of the modern era, we now have two perpetrators of sexual abuse and or sexual assault on the Supreme Court of the United States. And well, we continue to pretend that we don't, and that somehow that body has something resembling legitimacy, which it doesn't. But, Morans, right? Morans. Well, we have those. Oh, yes, we do. For the time being, let's just sort of put aside the what it is that's coming toward us and look at how god-awfully fucked up we are as we're sitting here waiting for the bus. Yeah. And that means, oh, checking in with just how nasty the maggots are. And by the way, in case you, just a gentle reminder that the United States sneezes and the world catches pneumonia. I guess you could say the maggot disease, and you know we saw it with Brexit, the maggot disease spreading around the globe. So let's go to merry oldie England. And except for the accent that goes with it, you could almost swear this was taking place in any town, USA. This is a subject of the coin who's screaming at an Asian woman who's a teacher on public transport. You know, the public transport we need more of in the United States in order to begin to address issues of climate change. But we've abandoned that because nobody likes talking about climate change and that sort of stuff. Let's do this instead.
Wait, hon! F*** you all! Get that on YouTube. Get it back to civilization, mate! Oh, I'm a Jeremy Carl wannabe. I couldn't give a f***. I'm British. Let Britain be British. Because I'm on a train now and one British on it! And what? Oh,
we're
literally crying.
Yeah.
The who?
Do you have anything else you
want to
add?
You.
And what's your message so I can get
you.
How do you feel about immigrants?
I want to feel about immigrants. Great Britain is a small country and it's not enough.
Okay.
We don't want any more immigrants. We want Britain to be Britain.
Alright.
Yeah.
That's enough, I think.
You know, you lose a lot in the beeping. You really do. There were several fuck-offs. Fuck you, bitch, fuck you. We want Britain to be British. And then there was that word that that equates with see you next Tuesday, that they use a lot more loosely and regularly in places like Australia and Great Britain, that no. Won't use it. That one, she hauls out that one at the Asian the Asian woman who's the school teacher. Yeah. Churchill would be so proud, wouldn't he? Don't you think? Yeah. And I don't know who Jeremy Kyle is. But I guess he's some sort of right-wing racist turd in England, in the UK. Yeah. that's for Jeff from Hill Hole, Indiana. Hashtag mega. Make England great again. Yeah. All right, what's up, Scott?
Hello, Bob.
Howdy.
Howdy. Happy Monday.
Yeah, or something.
Yeah, I know. It's not easy. It's just not easy.
You've still got the occasional vodka martini.
Well, yeah, that's true. Or I can sit here and, you know, puff on my pipe and contemplate, relax, and contemplate how not easy it is. Because you know they're headed here. eventually. I mean, their ultimate goal is to make all the currently blue states red. Pardon me. This is nothing to sneeze at, boys and girls. This is real. This is no movie. This is real. The last reel of this vintage motion picture. We're all screwed, Bob.
Well, I didn't want to go there on a Monday, but damn it.
Well, I mean, I keep kind of running around in my head, turning at every angle I can, and it's like an unsolvable Rubik's Cube that somebody has changed the colored stickers around in such a way that no matter how long you twist and turn that thing, you'll never get solid colors on all four sides. Or no, there's more.
No,
than
but
four
we'll
sides.
Just
six,
no, you won't. But we'll, but the political climate in this country says we'll just assume they're all white.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. All the sides are white. Jesus. And what got this going? It wasn't like the events of last week weren't enough, you know, to have you out on the front porch screaming at no one in particular and throwing stuff. At least me, that was my reaction to it. As if that weren't enough, I DVR all of the, were two of the Sunday morning talk shows. I DVR Meet the Press and Face the Nation. And our CBS affiliate out here, for some reason, maybe it butts up against sporting events, but by the time 8:30 shows up on the West Coast, here in San Diego anyway, our affiliate used to air the first half hour of Face the Nation live, and then they wouldn't play the second half hour until like 1 o'clock in the morning. You know, so it kind of takes some of the, you know, immediacy out of it. But they've got another station on our DVR system now, on my cable system, and they put the second half, the next half hour of it, at 9 o'clock. So you can tape them both and watch them, you know, all in all. But last night I was watching the two segments of Face the Nation. First of all, they have a teaser for this past Sunday night's 60 Minutes, where Scott Pelley talks to Susan Collins and the Democrat in, was it North Dakota, who voted no, that they were counting on?
Well, Heidi Heitkamp got it right.
Yeah. So there was that little bit of the Susan Collins version of GOP bullshit talking points. And then they go to a commercial. Then they come back, and John Dickerson, who's filling in for the regular host because she's on maternity leave, his guest live from Louisville, Kentucky, was that wretched old reprobate Mitch McConnell, gloating. And I posted the transcript of the interview on one of your Facebook threads where you were talking about Manchin and made a few salient points. For those of your Facebook friends who haven't seen it, click that link and look at that that interview with McConnell. I know you risk, you know, nonstop tossing of cookies. I'm sorry to you folks doing dinner out west here. But, you know, you risk it, but it's instructive. That's, you know, give that a look. But, it, you know, he's talking about, he, in air quotes, thanking the Democrats for, what was the word he used, energizing our Republican supporters, you know, in these waning days before the midterms. Oh, the audacity of that guy. Just, I mean, there's no end to it. I wasn't going to get this outrage so early in the call, but it's like, how can you help, you know, how can you keep from being outraged? But then, you know, and he gets worse. I won't go into the rest of the dialogue, but it was just, one bullshit thing after another with him. And I can't, one of your people on Facebook was talking about they've been using this Energize meme for a while now, the last couple of weeks or maybe a couple of months. And one wonders if that's them whistling past the graveyard where their minions out in the hinterlands are not actually energized. And they're just saying that, you know, for some false confidence that they, as Red Fox, the noted political philosopher, said, when you can read the handwriting on the wall, you're in the toilet. Maybe they see the handwriting on the wall, at least in terms of the House control with this set of midterms coming up. Who the hell knows with these people? They're always fake, trying to fake everybody out, and they're doing a bang-up job, given who's currently occupying, you know, the Oval Office. Have you started reading Fear, the Bob Woodward book?
Yeah, I have, although it seems like it feels like ancient history now.
Yeah, it does, but it's instructive, I think. And also, a couple of TV viewing things while I'm thinking about it. A week or so ago, Frontline had a two-hour piece. I think the title was Trump's... What the hell was that? Trump's Showdown. Anyway, it was a recent Frontline, and you can find it. That recaps all of it. From before the word go, you know, during the campaign, right up almost to the present day in terms of his ongoing shenanigans and madness and horseshit. And that's worth watching. And for those up there who are fans of the AMC series, the prequel sequel to Breaking Bad, called Better Call Saul, tonight is the season 4 finale at 9 p.m. Eastern. The show will run extra long. It's something like 90 minutes, including commercials. So if you DVR it, make sure that your DVR knows and, you know, allow for at least 90 minutes worth of recording.
Well, since we have moved over into TV watching, let me throw something out there for your just because these weird little moments. Okay, so here's the setup. I mentioned that Agnes and I were finally getting around to watching the second season of Goliath on Amazon Prime. Okay.
Yeah, and I keep meaning to start watching that.
Well, watch the first one first, and then the second season. The first one.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Because you get all the character development, et cetera. But Agnes had never seen the first season, so it was good. I didn't mind rewatching it. It had been a couple of years, so we did. And this is one of those things that happens when you're watching something and you also pay attention to the culture.
Yeah.
In episode 3 of the first season, okay, set up. Remember when Brat was asked about what he knew about the filthy proclivities of Judge Alex Kaczynski?
Mm-hmm.
You remember that?
Yeah.
And it turned out that Alex Kaczynski had a predilection for hiring attractive female law clerks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of the way Brat does.
Yeah.
And he would bring them into his office and show them porn and ask them if they thought it was obscene.
Yeah.
Or talk to them about their attire. And it became an open, a thing that was openly known among that rarefied atmosphere of people who run around applying for federal judge clerkships, that he was a filthy old perv. And in point of fact, Brett Kavanaugh probably did perjure himself when he said, "Oh, well, I didn't know anything about it." You know, he was one of his clerks, which probably means that he shared a chuckle or two at some piece of pornography that Alex Kaczynski was engaged in viewing. But of course, he just lied. He lied like a rug and said he didn't know nothing about no pornography with Alex Kaczynski. Well, just because the goddess of irony is a good goddess who sometimes, you know, sometimes she just throws something out there for the fun of it. In the third episode of season one of Goliath, there's a scene in which William Hurt is having lunch with a guy, and they're in a club, and there's fine china and the clinking of silver plate on porcelain, and they're talking about, you know, the judiciary, because Hurt's character is a big mover and shaker with a big defense contractor law firm. And the guy who will eventually try the big case, an African-American man, comes walking up, and they subtly suggest that if he wants to move up in the judging world, he needs to make certain things happen. Well, he is portrayed as having been a former law clerk of the judge who's sitting there talking with William Hurt's character. Mm-hmm. The guy playing the federal judge is Alex Kaczynski.
Oh, wow.
And so, as a former law clerk, that kind of makes the African-American man who walks up there being given advice on whose favor he needs to curry in order to advance, that puts him in the position of being roughly in the same position that Brett Kavanaugh was in.
Yeah.
How's about that, sports fans?
Well, and that's in a drama. That's in a fiction piece of a dramatic type.
Right. So here's a question.
Yeah.
What was he doing in a TV show when he's a member of the federal judiciary?
Well, I don't know what the rules are on those things. I know there are several movies over the years of recent vintage where sitting senators or congressmen or mucky mucks have short cameos. This was a speaking part, apparently.
It was a speaking role, and he was a federal judge. I mean,
yeah, I don't get that.
Especially in light of the nature of the conversation taking place, damn, that smelled an awful lot like an appearance of impropriety. But remember, Alex Kaczynski was a right-wing piece-of-shit judge, and I-O-K-I-Y-A-R.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's the rule. That's they want to make it, the hard and fast, coast-to-coast rule. I mean, that's their all. That's, like I say, while we're on that topic of people showing up in TV shows, I'll go back to that documentary I was mentioning last week, Dark Money, that's on the PBS series POV, and you can watch it online. And I think it's also on Amazon Prime for a couple of bucks. And I guess there's so much stuff to keep track of. This little factoid slipped my radar, or slipped past my radar. You remember one of Trump's many lawyers who have come through the revolving door in less than 2 years? I think it's Don McGahn.
Yeah, the current White House counsel.
Okay, I'm watching this documentary, Dark Money, which is about the influence of dark money, for those wondering about such things. Turns out, not too many years ago, Don McGahn was one of the three Republicans installed onto the Federal Election Commission and huddled with the two other Republicans, because it's a 3-3 setup, three from each party. Therefore, nothing gets done if the three Republicans decide that nothing will get done. Okay? This is the Federal Election Commission. Okay. Apparently, going in, he huddled with the other two Republicans on the board. And they concluded to collude to have no meaningful change occur by blockading with a three-vote tie. Because in this case, a tie means that nothing changes, whereas with a tie...
Yeah, the tie does not go to the runner.
Yeah, yeah. And it's like Jesus, you know, it's we need new blood in our government, which is why I'm happy about so many women running for seats on all levels of government, but especially Congress in this election coming up. The characters, they just never go away. It's like they hate big government. They hate the institutional aspects of it and the never-ending participation by people in what they call big government. But it's like the old country song, how can I miss you if you won't go away? You know? It's maddening. It's maddening. And this is the bullshit that we have become acclimated to and put up with, or have up until recently. Maybe we're finally going to do something about it. But the thing about Face the Nation that I didn't mention, after Susan Collins in the first segment and then Mitch McConnell in the second segment, John Dickerson at the end of the McConnell visit says, we contacted several Democrats to invite them to be on the program, and they all said they it was not something they were interested in doing. What? The momentous week that we had this past week, and you're telling me on that particular Sunday morning show, which is church for some people, you know, for political junkies, you mean to tell me that no Democrat was willing to carry their raunchy butts up to M Street, across from the old FCC location, where CBS used to be? I don't know if it's still there. They were disinclined to show up to say something for the record. What could their possible motivation be? You know, especially he's getting all, you know, thanking the Democrats, in air quotes, for sending out the activists and the mob to harass the Republican members of Congress in the hallways and at their homes. It's like, that just rubbed me the wrong way, as you can probably tell. But, I mean, what would possess Democrats not to take that opportunity, especially in light of the spin that McConnell is putting on, you know, this so-called energizing? Can you explain that to me?
I'm hoping that you're right in suggesting that it's a case of whistling past the graveyard.
Yeah.
But then again, yesterday and particularly Saturday night, there were parties all over the United States, and hashtag beer for Brett, okay? In fact, the college Republicans had a butt hurt sad at the University of Washington. Chevy Swanson, the president of the college Republicans at the University of Washington, it said they're contemplating suing a bar. Schultz's Bar and Grill. Because the college Republicans wanted to have a beers for Brett party. And Schultz's said, no, we're not going to host that because we don't host any political gatherings. So 15 nice, pale, white college Republicans got together and had drinks at Schultz's anyway. But Chevy Swanson said, it's very disheartening just to see something like this would get shut down or be asked to shut down for not any good reason. Well, the good reason is that Schultz's doesn't want to be political.
Yeah.
So they don't accept political, but that whole beers for Brett thing, you know, that people were, you know, and, you know, made a rape victim cry to own the libs.
Yeah.
But they are, and frankly, had Kavanaugh been defeated, they probably would have been more energized.
Well, yeah, that's a thought. I mean,
but again, I come back to what I've been saying, that a lot of this blue wave, well, it amounts to unhatched chicken counting.
Yeah.
And especially in light of the House races, God damn it, Scott, you've got to take in, and I mean, I'm not cussing at you. It's
no,
more exclamatory. You've got to take into account the gerrymandering. I mean, do you take the first district in Texas. That's mm-hmm. the home of Louis Asparagus Gohmert.
Oh, yeah, that's not going anywhere.
He's not going anywhere. You'd probably have to have something approaching 100% participation by the Democrats and a few crossover Republicans to defeat him because of the way that district is drawn.
Yeah.
And that, you know, that's replicated all over the country. So I'm trying to, okay, there are some bright spots. There's a fighting chance that every contested race with a Republican in it in California might wind up going to a Democrat.
Yeah, I heard that.
That's like six. Okay, so 23, we need 23 seats. That's 23 minus six, that's 17. And
well, and there's more than a few House districts in the what they call the exurbs, you know, which is I think a little further out or closer in suburb of major cities. There's more than a few races where there's a Republican in there currently, and those races are looking favorable for the Democrat because those types of districts tend to have moderates who are upwardly mobile and intelligent and college educated, who sometimes will lose their mind and vote for a Republican, but many times they will vote for a Democrat, especially when the Republican is so blatantly not doing his or her job. I mean, you see that a lot. I guess D.C. would not be a good example in terms of suburban House districts in Maryland and Virginia. But there are other principal cities. There are Republicans like close in, but they're not in what you would call predictably safe seats this time around. And like you said, the magic number is 23. And you know that I call history into the, you know, I quote history looking back at the 74 midterms. And I know that was 74 and this is 2018. But there's a dynamic at play which is still valid. And that is, it's not a safe time for some Republicans in some districts this time around. It's just not. And some of it is a reaction to the performance of the House in the past 2 years, but some of it is also in reaction to the excesses and the fear attached to just what a crazy person we have in Trump. And I think people are ready for a little course correction. I hope they are. And I know we go round and round, you know.
We had to get up and go to the doctor this morning for an appointment for Agnes, but I caught a little bit of my filthy habit this morning.
Yeah.
And they interviewed this noted conservative columnist, commentator, what have you, a guy named Max Boot. What a great name. Not quite as cool as Max Headroom, but still. You know, he made the argument that he said, I'm no longer a Republican. I don't even know if I'm a conservative anymore. And he sort of centered it all around the fact that When he was 6 years old, his Russian Jewish family emigrated to the United States during the era of Reagan, and Reagan is God.
Yeah.
I do get so very tired of the Reagan hagiography on that program. But then again, I don't watch it for news. I watch it for entertainment value. Because I can't get the channel that's all Three Stooges all the time. But he said... he said, as far as he's concerned, everybody should vote, people like him should vote straight ticket Democratic Party. And then he said, the GOP needs to be razed to the ground. Okay, I'm game.
Works for me.
I brought this up Friday evening, and I think it probably bears repeating. Just in, A, for people who didn't hear it Friday evening, and B, because you've got a sort of, what did Dim Leader say? Catapult the propaganda. the 2020 senatorial election map looks almost like a mirror image of this year's. In it, Republicans have to defend 20 seats, and Democrats have to defend about maybe 13. And recognizing that sweeps are not something that happen very often, unless you're like, you know, Atlanta Braves, then what we have here is there is still a fighting chance of taking the Senate and having a 51-49 majority.
You mean this time?
Or yeah, this time, like this time, this time. Yeah. Still, that chance does exist.
Yeah,
I don't know what the odds are, you know, out at Ladbrokes, but still, the chance exists. So working from
the stars will have to be in alignment,
and we'll all have to hold our tongues the right way and put one hand in the air. And yeah, I get that.
Yeah, it's like getting a good signal on a rabbit ears on an old black and white TV set in a big city.
Yeah, exactly.
You can do it, but you look like avant-garde art sculpture.
So
pose that you.
So let's take that and say, the stars align and we get a 51-49 majority in the Senate. Well, okay, then we immediately start looking toward 2020. In 2020, if you could sweep that, you wind up with 71 Democrats, or 71 people caucusing with the Democrats, and 29 caucusing with the Republicans. Okay,
boy, you haven't seen those numbers in the Senate for a while.
No, but it's an important number because that you've got to set goals, and that's a goal worth having. Because that's a Senate that can remove Donald Trump from office, assuming, of course, that he gets a second term, which I am not willing to discount. Okay?
Yeah.
So, January 2021, you've got a chance to do something about a reelected Trump. And remember, the Senate will be sworn in before the inauguration takes place.
Yeah, I think it's the 3rd of January.
Yeah.
3rd or the 6th, I forget which.
So for my, you know, for my money, that's worth fighting for. And that would achieve the ability, that would achieve what Max Boot was talking about. Raise the GOP to the ground. Now, the dynamics are going to be different because it'll be a presidential election year, so you'll have higher turnout. But it will also be the first best chance to remove peacefully, legally, and constitutionally Donald Trump from office.
Yeah.
And what I said over the weekend in a tweet or something, the guy who was the owner and publisher of the Charleston Gazette was a man named Ned Chilton. And he has interesting history. And he used to point towards something called sustained outrage. And that phrase is important. outrage will get you so only so far. It's the sustained outrage that makes the difference. And if we can sustain the outrage from now until November 2020, exhausting though it will be, big good things can happen.
Yeah. And one of the things that we will by then have going for us, I mean, potentially, and there's a strong possibility that I'm right about this, you know, let's say the House is taken over by the Democrats this time around in the midterms, and they're all sworn in January of 2019. That is going to cause Trump to be massively unhappy, and we all know from the past almost 2 years, even before in the run-up to the election, we all know, we've witnessed, there are many examples to point to, that when Trump is mad or angry or unhappy, he tends to act out. Because let's go to first principles here. His hard wiring is such that he detests being made to look bad, and he has trouble with people ridiculing him or laughing at him, okay? And you know that once, if the House is taken by the Democrats, there will be hearings, there will be investigations. In other words, Congress will act in a manner that's consistent with their job, okay, unlike the past 2 years. And that will not bode well for Trump in terms of what will be uncovered and also his reaction to things that are uncovered. So we'll have 2 years of a further off-the-twig Trump in our column, because the more he becomes destabilized, the more people will come to realize, I mean, you run a risk with destabilization with this guy, but there's also a benefit or a plus side, and that is the more wackadoodle in his behavior and reactions that he gets, that's just, arrows in our quiver for that eventual time, you know, if we do sweep the Senate in 2020, to move forward in a more, concrete, usable way in the wake of 2020. So, yeah, I'm on board with that. I'm nothing if not patient. As for the sustained outrage, that does cause wear and tear on a soul, especially if you're not focused on future benefits from your current actions. If you're a short-term thinker, you can't even manage sustained outrage, much less the motivation, the proper motivation for sustained outrage, because you're a short-term rewards person. But most people who play, what did Mitch McConnell call it, the long game or the long con?
Yeah, the long game, yeah.
They see the wisdom and the benefit. Maybe not, the payoff isn't immediate, but it's obtainable if you stay steady. Keep your hand on the plow and your eyes looking at the furrow ahead of you. That's pretty much right, isn't it? I mean,
well, yeah, it is, and the sustained outrage is difficult, Scott. But here, let me give you this.
Yeah,
they're going. The Republican Party has the bit in their teeth. They think they just won something big, and no one dares tell the maggots that this guy got onto the court with fewer votes than any other Supreme Court justice in history.
Historically, few votes, as I recall.
Yeah, that's what I just said. So they're gonna press it. You know, Chinless Mitch said, well, this will blow over. We have these little tempests in the teapots when the little ladies get their panties in a wad, but this will blow over. No, he didn't say that part. I said that part, but you know he's thinking it. Well, is it going to blow over? Or maybe when they get around to foisting tax cut part two on us, will we pay attention to that? There's going to be plenty of stuff to sustain. You know, we're not going to have to look for stuff to be to sustain our outrage. Is what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
And there are always those things out there that can happen that. Have a way of being unlooked for game changers.
Well, yeah, and that's why I was thinking that the business of a more unstable, unhappy Trump in reaction to Democrats taking the House in the midterms, that will play into that dynamic. But what you said about McConnell being true, what you said is true about McConnell's standard operating procedure. And again, I invite people who are on Facebook, or they can go online and find the Face the Nation transcript of the interview between John Dickerson and Mitch McConnell. He almost spells out the game plan. He does. He spills the beans in terms of showing his hand and his thinking and his game plan for the days and months and years ahead, if things go well for them. And he does it, the topic of what happened to Merrick Garland came up in the course of this interview. And I won't spoil it. This will be to urge you to look at that transcript to find out the qualified, you know, meaning-twisting, parsing, endless parsing that he had to do in justification of what he did to Merrick Garland's nomination to fill Scalia's seat. And I was amazed that Dickerson did not more forcefully challenge McConnell. At one point, McConnell said, well, you're not listening to what I'm saying, John.
Oh, and I know. He was full of beans, too.
Well, I mean, read the transcript. The link is in that thing I posted on your Facebook thread about Manchin. Read the transcript. His own words are there. If you have any doubts or questions about what McConnell's up to with the long con, he tells you by what they've already done. So it's instructive. It's distasteful, but it's also instructive.
The theory that we have members of the community who don't necessarily reveal themselves but take advantage of things that happen here.
Yeah.
Did you happen to catch the Senate Republican locker room scene from Saturday Night Live?
Yeah. Yes, I did. I did.
Did you notice, and I'm the only one who calls him Chinless Mitch McConnell, okay?
Yeah.
Did you notice that McConnell was portrayed as being without a chin?
Yeah.
Hi, Saturday Night Live. Welcome, writing staff. Glad to have you on board. Thanks.
Yeah. yes. Well, this is not the first time major programs have dipped into some of the stuff we talk about on this show.
No, and I fully expect somebody to pick up on Michael and Madison's "You Can't Handle the Boof." That's just not going to sit around without being touched.
Well, I had one happen to me the other day, more or less. I mean, I was talking about the confirmation of Kavanaugh on my Facebook, and I used the example. This is Friday night, now that I think about it, in the evening, and I used the example of the Democrats once again being like Charlie Brown, having the football snatched away by Lucy. And later, when I played the DVR recording of Real Time with Bill Maher, he alluded to that same dynamic. And I'm sure it was a case of, you know, great minds thinking alike, or, you know, the commonality of a notion. You know, one person thinking of something doesn't preclude the possibility that more than a few people out there scattered, you know, in the bulrushes and stuff, had that same thought. So it wasn't like gimmick infringement or anything like that at play. But no, I don't doubt at all that you know, writers on programs listen to what's going on, and among the places they listen is here. So hello, SNL. You're doing a great job. You know, some weeks it's spotty, but you usually get it right.
Well, and Kate McKinnon as Lindsey Graham, well, she's found another great character. And of course, that's deeply offensive to Geezer Disgustus, because, you know, girls. Here's a fun one for you. We have to analyze these things now the way we used to look at behaviors in the Soviet Union. So they had their big swearing-in ceremony for Brett Kavanaugh at the White House tonight.
Yeah, that was the photo op.
Yeah, guess who wasn't there?
I don't know. I didn't see it.
Melanoma.
Oh, really?
She has a long-standing prior commitment she was unable to change at the last minute. I guess she didn't want to be groped or, you know, attempted raped or anything by the by the new sociopath justice to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
Oh, and
Trump make remarks at the photo op, the swearing-in photo op?
Yes, he apologized to Brett Kavanaugh for anybody saying he ever tried to rape anybody.
Oh, give me a fucking break. Give me a fucking break.
Yeah, I guess he was apologizing on behalf of Dr. Ford. Here's a fun one, though, from the Read the Tea Leaves department.
Yeah, and that's a good analogy, by the way. Like in the 80s, in the 70s, trying to sort out what the Soviets were up to without having eyes on it necessarily.
Well, so Saturday morning I got up and I'd already seen the, you know, because she went on her great African tour, Melanoma did. And we'd already seen the picture of her wearing her colonial Mwana, white colonialist pith helmet.
Wait a minute. Let me ask you something just for a point of order. Some of the pictures that I saw were like from the mid-chest up, okay? Was she also wearing jodhpurs?
I don't know. Scott, for purposes of this discussion, we're only dealing with the headgear.
Okay, thank you.
So I'd seen that and I went, well, that's weird. And I got up Saturday morning and I saw another picture of her. And just because my memory is the way that it is, I went, wait a minute. Okay, pith helmet. All right. But the next one was a picture of her standing in front of the fucking Sphinx wearing a white straw Panama hat.
Yeah.
And a whitish men's style suit jacket. And summoning up my inner Indiana Jones, I went, Belloc. So then I went and looked up pictures of Belloc from the Indiana Jones movies, and sure enough, my memory was correct. There was a picture of Belloc in a pith helmet, and there's Melanoma in a pith helmet. There's a picture of Belloc standing, you know, the Nazi villain, the villain archaeologist, standing in front of Egyptian ruins wearing a light-colored suit jacket and a white Panama straw hat, And it's like they had dressed her out of his wardrobe.
Yeah.
What the actual fuck?
Well, maybe this, you remember the Woody Allen film, Annie Hall?
Yeah, but hold up. Wait.
Well, it could be a fashion trend being started.
No, stop. All stop.
Okay, go ahead.
They deliberately dressed her twice on her African tour as the Nazi archaeologist villain from Indiana. Nazi, Scott! Nazi!
I know.
And you know, I don't go over onto 4chan or 8chan or any of that website that rhymes with light and fart. But, goddamn! I mean, that wasn't a dog whistle. That was a goddamn foghorn blast on a clear day.
Yeah, but that feeds into what I was saying, Bob. It's like if you want to convey a mindset to people and have it really catch on more than it already has for 2019, it's the Nazi look. And you have the guy at the end of the fashion runway.
You know, it would be absolutely ironically hilarious if the jacket and hat were by Hugo Boss.
Give yourself a cowboy belt.
I don't think I could stand that.
Tell them, for those who don't know, Hugo Boss's role in the Reich. The fashion trends of the right.
Jawohl. he designed the SS's uniforms.
Oh, you look hot. Smashing. I laugh to keep from screaming.
Du bist so hot. Yeah. Sehr hot. I'm too sexy for my goose step. Too sexy for my goose step. Too sexy. But I'm sorry, I just thought that was fucking weird. Once and you go, ah. Twice and you go, wait a minute.
Yeah.
And the one with the Panama hat was almost like you could do an overlay.
Yeah.
Because with the pith helmet, her pith helmet was, of course, pure white. Belloc's pith helmet, pith. Yes, I need to take one, Thune. Belloc's pith helmet was khaki. We better get away from this one before I get into trouble. Hey, Scott, I'm going to try to create a little room if anybody else wants to jump in, my friend.
All right, Bob. Take care. Have a good rest of the week. We're hopefully looking forward to. These midterms. I mean, people, there's still time to register and get your friends registered and then go as a group to vote.
And by the way, a bunch of folks who had registered to vote in Texas got their registrations thrown out by the Secretary of State of Texas because, well, they might be the wrong color.
Yeah, well, color me not surprised.
Yeah, no.
Okay, Bob.
No, seriously, like 2,500 people.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what they're up to.
Because they were because they signed their voter registrations electronically, and apparently the electronics don't work down in Texas.
There you go.
There's always
something with these people.
Yeah, you'd think that in a democracy the idea would be to have more people vote, but oh well. Yeah, democracy? What democracy? Later, Scott.
Yeah. All right, Bob. Take care.
Bye now. It's our buddy Scott calling from San Diego. Both lines are open if you want to jump into the conversation now. 304-574-8178 or 304-640-2829. Toll free from anywhere in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, 844-843-4676. A couple of emails to share. Freight Train Frank with a note coming in from Iowegia. I will not be moved like a tree standing by the river. I will not be moved. I've faced many challenges in my life, and I've withstood them. I was told that I was going to lose my eyesight when I was 18 years old. Over the past 50 years, I've lost most of my eyesight, but I will not fall into despair. I have chosen to be determined and to overcome the challenges I face. Like many who have preceded us, I will not be moved. Don't let the bad guys win by discouraging you about the future. We've been through dark times, and we will survive these times as well. The great challenge is to maintain our determination in the face of adversity. Thank you, Frank. Thank you very much. By the way, Steve from Georgistan reminds us that the Face the Nation podcast is available via Stitcher. Let's see here. Robert in Australia with a note says, life in 2030, it's only 12 years from now, so I don't see a huge difference in the way people live. And persuading people to change the way they live will be the problem. Talking to a neighbor about climate change, she felt that Australia didn't have to do anything because we're such a small country. Never mind, it's the largest net exporter of coal in the world, but anyway. Only 25 million people. I tried to explain that if Australia does nothing, it's an excuse for everyone else to do nothing. I gave up on the conversation after a while when my neighbor started to get agitated. We used to have a carbon tax here in Australia. It should have been called a license to pollute tax. If it had, I think more people would have understood what it was about. Most people just saw it as another tax. The Liberals removed it because of its effect on business. In other words, they were helping out their mates in the coal industry. At the time, our then PM, Tony Abbott, said of climate change, "That's all bullshit." And it's been downhill ever since with regard to the Liberals. They brought a lump of coal into the Parliament House because it's the fuel of the future of some sort or some bullshit. Stealing lines from Joe Manchin again, I see. Again, it was all about helping their friends in the coal industry. The revenue raised from the carbon tax just went into general revenue, which was a mistake. It needed to go into an alternative energy plan. Solar panels on every roof, a new electricity grid, and so on. A few square kilometers of solar panels in Central Australia could power the country. No need for new coal-fired electricity plants, which is the current plan. A few hundred square kilometers and we could be exporting power to Asia. Then there's the national broadband network that the Liberals fracked over. I saw it as a way for thousands of people to work from home 3 or 4 days a week. Imagine all those people not having to commute. It's really going to take something massive and unexplainable to change people's minds about climate change. A change to the jet stream, air movements change, and we start getting air from Antarctica, and a meter of snow in the streets of Sydney might do it for Australians. So, life in 2030? I don't see it being that much different from now unless an historical discontinuity pops up, like the Saudis stop selling oil because it's all gone. And those rich bastards are making plans. They're in the process of building massive solar farms in the middle of their godforsaken desert, which is a great place for massive solar farms. That might shock them stop selling oil. That might shock, says Robert, the world's people into changing their attitude and forcing their government to switch to renewables ASAP. Two documentaries worth watching on this topic, After the Warming by James Burke, The Age of Stupid by the BBC. It's a 2050 look back at how the world got into the mess it's in 2050. They both sound interesting. James in Illinois says, we need Louie Gohmert. There will be Republicans. Shouldn't there be stupid people in the stupid party? You need some just to remind people how fucking awful they are. Clarification, Irish Dave points out, fewest votes in a 100-member Senate, yes. Thinking back to when there were fewer senators, one would think in absolute terms John Marshall didn't get no 40-plus votes, for example. No, he probably didn't, but he probably got something approaching 100% or near of the available members of the Senate, which would have been, 26, maybe 28, maybe 30 total? Yeah. Oh, don't even say that, James in Illinois. Donnie's going to switch parties. He'll have an epiphany and beg us to nominate him. Subject line, flipper. And I want to go back to this because Randy and PA brought it up, and I'm going to go back to the phones in a minute. By the way, we're still stuck at $314 to go in fundraising. It would be really awesome if it wasn't $514 tomorrow. If we could knock down another $114 just so that we would have last week finished off, that would be awesome. So whatever is helpful, and we got 20 minutes or so to do it, because the podcast crew generally, it generally happens during the program. Let's just put it that way. But I want to go back to something procedurally that happened during the confirmation vote on Brat. And that is that after the vote had been taken, it came very close to being a fucked up situation. Because Lisa Murkowski, true to her word, had voted no. But Steve Daines was too busy with his daughter's wedding to bother to do his damn job and show up in the Senate to cast his vote. So he wasn't there to vote. Nobody could cast it for him. So that meant that the Republicans were sorely lacking in a vote. That being the case, Lisa Murkowski, when the voting was done, changed. She said, well, Steve Daines wasn't here, but my good friend would have voted in favor of the nomination, so I'll change my vote to present. And that allowed Brat onto the court. So she was a no vote because of all the pressure that was put on her, among other things, by indigenous groups in Alaska. And I got to wonder how that's sitting with them. Because for all intents and purposes, she may as well have been a yes. She canceled her vote out in favor of a Republican who would have voted yes, but put his daughter's wedding ahead of the good of the country, regardless of which way the vote would have gone. He did that. Randy asking, how feckless can you get voting present? Well, if we're talking about Republicans, pretty damn feckless. Lee in New York says, it's not just you. With a link, Melania Trump dresses like an Indiana Jones villain, prompting everyone to make the same joke. Oh, well, good. Glad to know I'm tapped into the zeitgeist. I wonder where that comes from. Working. Entertainment.ie. Oh, yeah, they saw it too. How's about that? Thanks, Lee. Let me check. Yeah, Marty says, and led by Shannon Moore and Jean Devon, women in Alaska are pissed. Good. Ah, okay, thank you. Randy in PA tells me an IE ending originates in Ireland. Okay, that's helpful. Okay, over to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Is this you talking to me?
I'm talking to you.
Ah, okay, yeah, this is Charlie. I've got a couple of a comment and a question. I'll start off with my question. Whenever I try to donate to your program, it used to set everything up in PayPal, and I just had to hit donate, and it was gone. That doesn't seem to work anymore.
I know they've changed their interface, their app, and all that kind of stuff. The best thing is just to go to headon.live and use the link there.
I do, and it doesn't set anything up.
I don't quite know what you mean by it doesn't.
Well, used to whenever I would hit donate to Head On Radio, it would set everything up, and you just hit donate, and it said you just sent Bob Kincaid or whatever so many dollars. It doesn't do that anymore. It brings up a list of contacts. Say, okay, who do you want to donate to? And it's like, you know, it's frustrating.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know about that. That might be something. I don't know if that's something in your browser or.
It's on a Android phone. And it used to work. I mean, I used to send you money, you know, every once in a while, but I can't do it anymore. What is your address to send money to on the program through PayPal?
Just BobKincaid@gmail.com.
Oh, BobKincaid@gmail.com, and it'll go?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, cool.
Okay.
And the next thing I wanted to ask you is, I have read and read and read and read our Constitution. And, you know, everybody's upset about Kavanaugh being appointed to the court. But in our Constitution, I don't read anything about 9 Supreme Court justices.
Nothing there. You won't find it in the Constitution, Charlie. That's a number that's established by Congress.
Well, I mean, can't Congress expand it and say, okay, Mr. Kavanaugh?
They certainly can.
You got a company now.
They certainly can.
I'm just waiting for something like that to happen. You know, I'm not really surprised that Kavanaugh made it on the court.
Neither am I. I predicted he would.
Republicans are stupid people. They are really, everyone of them stupid as all get out. If they don't have a leader to tell them what to do, they're clueless. And their leader told them to put Kavanaugh on the court.
Well,
before
that happened, he also, Mitch McConnell, remember, for Gorsuch's sake, he blew up the rules. See, back when Harry Reid was the largely ineffectual majority leader of the Democrats, and the Democrats had the majority, he got rid of the filibuster for lower federal court justices. Okay?
Right.
Circuit Court of Appeals and downward. But there was still a 60-vote threshold majority requirement for Supreme Court justices. Well, Mitch McConnell knew that having done to Merrick Garland what he did, he would never get 60 votes for any Trumpian Supreme Court nominee. So, therefore, he blew that up so that it just takes a 51-49. You know what I mean. It's me, math,
yeah.
You know. He got rid of that. So that they could go ahead and pack the court. And here's the thing that's really sobering. There's a reasonable likelihood that just in this presidential term, Donald Trump will get another Supreme Court nomination. Maybe two. And that would take it to a 7-2 majority. Now, for anybody, and the only way we stop that is by getting a majority in the Senate.
Okay.
And that is one of the primary reasons that, as disgusting as it makes me feel.
Well, Bob,
I'm going to vote for Joe Manchin.
Oh, Joe Manchin's a piece of shit.
Yes, he is. Yes, he absolutely is.
I don't even see any difference between him and Zell Miller. I don't.
Well, really the don't. Difference isn't between him and Zell Miller. The difference is between him and Patrick Morrissey. Joe will vote with the Democrats about 60-70% of the time. Patrick Morrissey will vote with the Democrats 0% of the time. Joe Manchin is a piece of shit. But I don't have any choice here. Because I have to, you know, as I've said before, I have to vote like a West Virginian. I mean, I have to vote like an American, not like a West Virginian. I can't vote my state's internal petty politics. I have to I have to vote to try to give a majority to the Democrats in the Senate so that we can stop. You know, you're never going to get 67 votes to impeach Donald Trump or Brett Kavanaugh, for that matter. But 51 votes in the Senate will stop anything that Donald Trump wants fucking done.
Well, you know, the Constitution said that the Senate shall determine how it's going to do business. And having said that, we also read that the vice president casts a tiebreaker.
Correct.
So why in the world would the Senate be able to have this supermajority if the vice president's there to break a tie?
It seems
to me like the Constitution is pointing to the fact that it should be a 50-50 vote in the Senate. You know, it shouldn't be 60-30 or whatever, or 60-40 or whatever it is.
Well, I mean, are you talking about percentages or not? I mean, at the time the Constitution was written, there were and ratified, there were what, 26 senators?
Uh huh.
So he's there to break a 13-13 tie.
But the Senate has already decided that they're going to have this super majority.
No. The super majority is a matter. It has to do with the history of the filibuster. The filibuster is not in the Constitution either.
Right.
So.
Well, why don't we start educating the Americans about the Constitution?
We try. Dr. Bill O'Brien's there Mondays, Tuesdays, and Wednesdays, busting his ass doing it. I mean, we're trying. But there are other outfits out there that will just make shit up. The way that Chinless Mitch made shit up this Sunday and got called out by John Dickerson, who said, you know. Chinless Mitch said, well, the president hadn't appointed Merrick Garland, 1887. And John Dickerson said, bullshit. 1957 or 1958, 1968. Oh, but the president was of the same party with the... No, because the appointment that that Eisenhower made in 1958 or whenever... had a Democratic Senate. McConnell is just playing, you know, blunt force political power politics.
And you know, I mean, people, there's certain things that are legal that you can do, like, you know, most of the people in this country, if Donald Trump came up and wanted to shake their hand, they'd just about pee all over themselves. And, you know, if he could come up and shake my hand, I'd kind of look at him and I'd say, no, I don't think so, and turn around and walk off.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just don't understand the people in this country. I really don't.
You live down there, Charlie. I think you understand them better than you let on.
Well, I'm over in East Tennessee now, so I'm no longer in around Nashville.
Well, but still, that doesn't change things much. Wasn't Trump rallying in East Tennessee recently?
Yeah, he came. What was it?
Johnson City or something?
Johnson City, yeah. And it, you know, I wouldn't care a bit just to look at him and say, Mr. Trump, every time you come up here, it screws up the traffic. Why don't you stay the hell in Washington? I mean, I just, you know,
well, because
that's
just
the way I am.
Because he hates his job. And at least when he comes down to East Trumpistan, the maggots are there waiting for him to cheer him on. He's like one of those Star Trek characters that lives on praise or something. He feeds on human fury and human fear and yeah. Okay.
I'm
yeah. Here's a, by the
him.
Way.
I just
no.
Don't want to have anything to do with him.
Here's a clarification from Irish Dave. 1956 was a presidential election year, and yes, the Democrats held the Senate. The Republicans had the White House, and the Democrats let him appoint a Supreme Court justice in an election year. So there, you know, there it is.
Well, I have no respect for Mitch McConnell. I just, you know.
Well, you're not going to find any of that here either.
Well, I used to live in Shepherdsville, Kentucky, and I thought the guy was a piece of work. And I thought his wife was twice as bad. You know, anybody that comes to this country and wants us to support Red China, no, leave the Chinese alone. You're an American now. You need to worry about America. Don't worry about where you came from.
I thought she came from Taiwan.
Well, she did, but her father came from. The way it is put on the internet is that her father left China to move to Taiwan, and that's not really what happened. The communists blockaded China. And he couldn't run the blockade, so he went to Taiwan because he couldn't get back to China.
Apparently, lucky for him, he had his money with him.
Yep.
Yeah.
So,
all right.
Know.
Well, Charlie, good.
I
understand your frustration. I get it completely. And, the central issue you brought up, there do not have to be 9 Supreme Court justices. There can be 99. Or 109.
Yep.
But I think it would probably do well enough just to say let's add 1, 2 let's add Merrick Garland and the 2 that replaced him. So, you know, maybe put 4 justices to the Supreme Court next time we get a Democratic president and a Democratic Congress, and just neuter Slappy and. Because I don't think you can take the number down, but you can certainly take it up.
I started to say, why don't we do that?
Yeah, just run it down to 1 and make it Ruth Bader Ginsburg. No. Hey, Charlie, we got to get out of here, though. You have yourself a good evening. Good hearing from you, my friend.
I'm glad you told me how to get a hold of, how to make a donation to your program, because it was frustrating me.
I appreciate it. I appreciate it very, very much indeed.
Okey-doke. Thank you.
All right. Bye now. That's our buddy Charlie, now of East Tennessee. And thank you very kindly to Charles, different Charles, in Florida, who helped out by finishing off last week's fundraising. Thank you, Charles. Thank you very, very much. That means that we finished the evening with just this evening's fundraising to do, which means tomorrow it'll be $400 instead of $514. And that's tremendous. Thank you, Charles. Thank you so very much. Very much indeed for helping us keep this little effort on the air. It is much appreciated. And it's time to get out of here. Moran Mondays have a way of just flying past. I have a feeling Titanic Tuesday will be something similar. So hopefully you'll be around tomorrow. Thanks to everybody who keeps this program going. Thank you so very much. And thanks to all of you who participate in this program and share your the time of your precious, finite existence on this little planet engaged in this conversation. I'm always deeply, deeply humbled and honored and amazed at the wondrous nature of the interplay of ideas that we have here. Thank you. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you, Sparky, in the chat room this evening. Thank you. To our news ninjas, thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you, John Fox in Australia. Thank you, Ben Birch, whiterosesociety.org. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, y'all.